Hello everyone, I'm Ian Wright, Marketing Manager at Acerta. Welcome to our webinar on Building an Industrial Data Science Strategy. I'm joined today by two experts on that topic, Acerta CTO Jean-Christophe Petkovic and Conway McKenzie Managing Director Matt Townsend. Our format today is based around four key questions that Matt and JC will answer and discuss. If you have any questions of your own, feel free to post them in the chat at any time. We'll start off with some introductions, followed by a brief explanation of why we think this topic is important, before we dive into the questions. So, as mentioned, my name is Ian Wright. I'm the marketing manager at Acerta. I've been with the company for just over a year. Prior to that, I was managing editor at engineering.com, where I oversaw coverage of manufacturing and new technologies, as well as hosting a fair number of webinars like this one. JC, do you want to go next?
Sure, yeah. I'm Jean-Christophe Petkovic, or you can call me JC. I'm the CTO of Acerta and one of its co-founders. I've worked in the automotive industry basically for every position I've ever held. And I have a weird mix of knowledge from everything between electrical engineering, semiconductor physics, all the way up to computer science and data science that I've gotten throughout my career. And more recently, I've focused on pattern recognition, anomaly detection, and analysis of real-time embedded systems. So that's what brought me here. That's kind of me in a nutshell, I guess.
Thanks, JC. And Matt?
Sure. Welcome, everybody. My name is Matt Townsend. I am the managing director of the Factory of the Future, or Connected Factory Group, as part of the technology enablement group at Conway McKenzie, a part of Riveron. Been in automotive my entire career in the tier one sector. And worked extensively with Acerta on a handful of machine learning projects, and very happy to be here.
All right, great. Thanks, Matt. So to start us off, I'm sure you're all familiar with terms like Industry 4.0, digital transformation, and most of us would probably agree that although these tend to be overused by marketers like me, those terms actually do point to real changes that are taking place in manufacturing today. And those changes are driven primarily by data. Now, our focus at Acerta is obviously the automotive industry, and by our own conservative estimates, automotive alone is currently generating almost 1,000 petabytes of data annually between production and on-road vehicles. And yet, by most estimates, the vast majority of that data ends up going unused. That's why it's important to have a data strategy, especially when it comes to manufacturing, since, as you can see from these figures, manufacturing accounts for almost 90% of the data produced by the auto industry. So with that in mind, I'd like to dive right into our first question. What manufacturing data should you be collecting?
So yeah, I can probably take a stab at that first, if you don't mind, Matt. I guess ultimately, when you determine what data you collect, you should endeavor to choose the set of information that you feel best represents your parts or your products. And it's kind of difficult to prescribe like a one-fits-all selection of metrics that you should collect. But I guess we can talk about kind of the universal needs that you're going to have when defining a fresh data strategy from scratch. So you're likely already collecting performance metrics about your plants, but if you aren't, obviously that's a pretty obvious place to start. But the second thing that you're going to want to do is try and link those performance metrics back to what influences those metrics on the line. So maybe you have an idea about this already, and that's probably the place that you should start. But if you're unsure, then maybe that warrants a little bit of experimentation or research about the line and its effects. But that might be another discussion. Ultimately, what you're going to want to collect about your units, the things that you're manufacturing, your products, you're going to want to know everything about the units that pass as well as those that fail, not just one or the other. And you're also going to want to know about those units that get reworked. You're going to want to understand any metrics about any processes or operations that you believe failure is really sensitive to. So without getting specific about any particular components or any particular products, I guess the last thing, and maybe the most important thing that you got to collect, and something that we see people ignore a lot at Acerta, at least at first, is traceability. You need traceability information about your data. So what do I mean traceability? Really what I'm talking about here is your ability to connect one piece of information to all the other information that you collect. It's kind of linked to the identity of a piece of data. Where did that piece of data come from? What product was it measured from? What operation did it come from? At what time was it collected? What line did it come from? What plant? All of this kind of information is useful because it lets you answer questions like, what other data do I have about that product? What other data do I have about that operation? Or what other data do I have about that line? Which is, all of these are questions that are crucial, that they're super important for you to be able to actually build any kind of successful data application from this data. It's ultimately the thing that lets you weave together all this information into some kind of tapestry, some kind of story about that product so that you can interpret it, so that you can try and make better choices. But that's just my opinion. What do you think, Matt?
On the manufacturing front, you're bang on, JC, but what most people fail to do is reach out with what they don't know. So everybody knows what they know, right? So we know that we have a certain outcome, and whether it's a quality prediction or like you talked about with a pass fail, right? So you have a certain set of criteria that either passes or fails in your process. And 9 times out of 10, the process engineer will say, if I move this widget will have that outcome change. If you think outside of those, so yeah, you want to collect that process data that everybody knows has an end result. But there's a lot of things that happen, and we know firsthand from what we've seen in our experience that there are other things that you don't know that have influences on top of that. So my suggestion is in your process data, you want to grab some environment data at the same time through sensoring, but in your process, you want to definitely grab as much as you possibly can of what you think will influence the outcome, as well as what you won't. And then we use the data science portion to blend the two of those together. And why don't you expand on that a little bit, JC, of what we've seen in the past, where we knew that certain things that we had no idea were influencing ended up being one of the contributing factors in some of the outcomes.
Sure. Yeah. So honestly, you're completely right. Like, starting with collecting the metrics that you believe are going to influence a particular result is a good start. But when you're starting out, it might even be better to cast a very wide net and collect as much as possible, because you may not have a good, or you may not have, let's say, a complete intuition about what's going to affect a particular process. And you may even believe that it might be impossible to achieve a particular result just because you're making the assumption that you understand the process completely, and you start with that kind of hypothesis in mind that, well, if I know X, Y, and Z, yeah, maybe I could predict A, B, and C, but if I don't have those, then it's impossible. So something that you and I both have had experience with is actually producing a result from something that nobody expected, right? We were able to build essentially a recommendation engine, you might think, about a selection process for a particular component on the line, and we were able to do it from data that's collected leading up to that point in the manufacturing line. I think that's kind of what you're referring to, is that right?
Yeah, and on top of that, we were trying to solve for X, and we ended up solving for Y based on other data that showed up in our process map. So just because you're trying to solve a certain problem doesn't mean you can't necessarily get a different outcome on a different problem with that same set of data. So, in my experience, you don't want to collect everything, because there's some things that actually totally mean nothing. But like you said, cast the largest web and make sure that the data that you are collecting is as organized as humanly possible, which I think we're going to talk about later on in this. But the organization of data and what the data sets look like in terms of the inputs to the model become extremely, extremely beneficial towards your end result.
Yeah, for sure. And there's this kind of sense from some people that data is kind of this new oil or something, where if you collect enough of it, you're going to be able to solve whatever problem might be related to that data. But in fact, if you just collect it blindly and you don't structure it, as you said, often you're going to find that data is actually pretty useless for the problem at hand.
Just to add to that, I'm curious. I don't think either of you mentioned, is there a good rule in terms of historical data and how far back ideally the data collection process should go?
That's actually a great question. So, you might be obligated for legal reasons to store records of certain kinds of data, but I think this might touch on another kind of important thing in my opinion, which is that manufacturing lines are kind of like a living, breathing organism. They change all the time, every day, and the data that they generate as a consequence also changes all the time. It shifts very subtly over time as a consequence of things such as like potentially even the weather or a change in shift or a change in steel supplier. It could be any number of things that you would never expect that could have an influence on that data. And as a consequence, there's kind of two answers to that question. Depending on how quickly your line changes, maybe only the recent months of data are relevant for solving one problem, but maybe if you want to understand in depth what has changed, it's better to store everything. And as a data scientist, of course, my opinion is that you should just store it for as long as possible, as long as it's practical. Because you never know when you might need to go back and pull out some data and try and compare it with something else or even use it for training. So, I mean, machine learning models' performance, their accuracy, their AUC, all their related performance metrics, they're going to increase the more data you have generally, asymptotically towards whatever their theoretical maximum is. But ultimately, you're going to want as much data as possible. What do you think, Matt? What's your opinion on it?
I'm going to use the word relevant. So we all know engineering changes happen, and we all know process changes happen. So the relevant process data that you can collect during the most current manufacturing process that you're trying to solve is exactly right. So, you know, you want a large amount of data that you talked about, JC, in terms of the model. But you also want to make sure that the data that you're presenting does not skew the results based on a process change.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that as well.
Okay. So we've touched on data collection, and I think we've kind of hinted toward this already, but the next, I think, logical question to ask is, how do you formulate your data storage strategy?
So that's another great question. And it does kind of link back to basically some of the things we talked about already, which is kind of what objective do you have in mind? Because your objective is going to determine your data needs. And the needs that you have for your data, for example, like, how much data do you need to collect? What throughputs are you expecting to have both for ingress and egress? And then what kind of processing requirements are you going to have for that data to accomplish whatever your goal is? And that's going to change things like, for instance, do you want a cloud-based solution? Do you want an edge-based solution? Or do you want a hybrid between the two? As an example, if you want to produce a result in near real time very quickly, maybe you need more edge compute so that you can respond as quickly as possible. And depending on the particular application, like let's say you're trying to make predictions as part of a manufacturing cycle, then maybe a response in sub 1 second is necessary. Well, then you really need to have a distributed data collection system where you have each line having its own kind of dedicated data collection mechanism and data associated database. And from the perspective of doing any kind of global based metrics, you're going to need to build a more federated system linking all that data together in a centralized location, kind of on a longer term basis. So like basically collecting the data locally and then shipping that to the cloud for aggregation so that you can use it for other kinds of purposes. Yeah, and I guess the other decisions that you need to make are between structured and unstructured data. Like how much unstructured data do you anticipate collecting versus structured? And in the case of manufacturing, obviously there's a lot of patterns, a lot of repetition, some rigid hierarchical structures in your data. So it does make more sense typically to have the majority, like 90% plus of your data in a very structured way. And still, I would still say you do need to kind of plan for unstructured data as well, because you never know when the process will change, and you don't want to have to adapt too hard in any one particular direction. You do want to have that flexibility. So I would recommend having some plan for unstructured data, but largely I think it's going to be as structured as possible.
And on the same note, JC, is you're going to have it from multiple places too. So as you know, the world evolves and we move out of just pure process data and we move into sensoring data, or you talked about environmental data or whatever, starting to feed that engine. And then on top, you mentioned something in the last slide, which was training. So there may be people on the call that don't quite understand that the models are constantly being trained. So you mentioned the word hybrid a minute ago. And so that is the method that we believe is the best. So you have the ability to take all of your different nodes that are producing the process data, move them up into a certain location that allows you to do training, and then have that engine running real time on-prem so that it can do what it needs to do if you're talking about a pure machine learning environment. So where you want to use your machine learning model to make changes to your line in order to increase your productivity or quality or first time through or whatever you're trying to solve, you need a hybrid approach to ensure that you have both sides of the fence covered. We're training correctly, and then we're also using that train model back down to actually do the work.
Yeah, for sure. I completely agree. And there's a lot of wisdom in taking a hybrid-based approach for other reasons as well. It might make the rollout of this data infrastructure a lot easier. So you might be able to have, for instance, already a working application based off of deployment of just the edge compute device in one line, and that will let you experiment with it a little bit more. And it'll let you kind of expand out towards that kind of federated approach at a later time.
And on that same note, JC, that we've always done in our cases is we've also run the model in a sandbox. So nobody wants to touch your process environment and have it not do what it's supposed to do and cause ill effects to the supply of product. So also being able to run this outside of the standard operating procedure of the equipment, to be able to run it in the cloud and run it in a sandbox environment, to have it predict what could happen, so we're kind of running them simultaneously, is also extremely important to making sure that the outcome is what you expect.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So I'm curious, Matt and JC, you both sort of, I think, endorsed a hybrid approach as being the best one for data storage, at least in manufacturing. How common is that approach right now, would you say, in your experience?
I think generally that's the direction that people are starting to go. You can see some first-class support from both AWS, Azure, and Google Cloud Services, basically building out these edge compute specialized devices that kind of act very similar to the cloud. And they're targeting industry and manufacturing for a lot of the deployment of these devices. So I think generally the cloud infrastructure guys are really trying to get into that market, and with good reason. I think that's the direction that people are going. That said, how many people are doing it right now that I've experienced? I'd say probably a low percentage, maybe 10 or 20% of the people that we've run into are doing this. How about you, Matt? What's your experience?
I would agree, because right now I think that the general norm, let's call it, is push everything into a data lake and then we're going to figure out what we're going to do with it later, which means basically pushing everything into one central location, right? Not understanding the full magnitude of what they can do with the data. And I think that's, you know, the outlying purpose of what we're all talking about in this webinar is, how do we take those people or those manufacturers or those clients in our case and take them to the next level by our experience and by how we know what works. So, yep, your question, Ian, is what's most people do? Most people just push it to a data lake and try to figure it out with some kind of analytics tool, not understanding the power of what machine learning is. And there's very few people in this world that really understand what that power is. And there's very, very even littler amount of people that are actually doing it on a day-to-day basis. It takes a leap. It takes somebody in the organization to say, yeah, I want to solve this problem. and I want to use the best technology and the most real world technology in order to get that solution done.
So that I can't help but ask a kind of a follow-up to that. I'm curious how you would each, I know we're going outside a little bit, but how would you each characterize manufacturing right now compared to other sectors? So if we're talking about retail or telecom or oil and gas resource extraction, anything in that vein, where would you put manufacturing in terms of its sophistication when it comes to data storage?
I got to say, from what I've seen of the retail side, for instance, they're very far along the construction of data infrastructure for their purposes and corresponding analytics. Like, there's lots of famous cases from Walmart, for instance, of what they've been able to do with data science and what they've been able to do with statistics and modeling. Same thing for Amazon. They've done a ton of different really cool things with data, like predicting what people are going to want is only the surface, right? It's how do you basket things together? How do you build the best recommendation engines? How do you influence people through advertising and similar? Like, those problems have really come a long way in recent years, and a lot of it's been pushed by the success that they've had in the retail industry. Matt, what about you?
So that's outside of my expertise. So I'm a purebred manufacturing rat, right? So I've been basically akin to manufacturing itself, and I can tell you when I was on the tier one side and I was looking for a partner, there were a lot of people that could tell me what color tile was going to be sold in October, and that's I think where it all started. But as the manufacturing levels have changed, especially within the last 6 months, that everybody's trying to get better, stronger, faster, quicker, right? So the only way to do that is to use data. And there are some plants and some, world-class companies that are using it exceptionally well. And there's others that you would assume are doing everything humanly possible that really aren't. And they're just collecting it for the sake of collecting it and still business as usual. So I think in my opinion, as manufacturing grows and as the industry 4.0 becomes more accepted, then all of that will change. And I think in the COVID world, we have really learned that everybody needs to be able to see the manufacturing environment from anywhere. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but that is the way everybody's talking now. I want visibility to my shop floor from anywhere. Not only to see, data that we're going to be using to manipulate for machine learning or AI, but even just purebred visibility that I know what's happening right now without physically standing in front of it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think that actually segues nicely into our next question as well. We've talked about storage, we've talked about collection, but what do you need to actually get use out of this data? If we're talking about getting real-time insights into the production process, what's required for that?
So I can tell you this is the hardest thing to get done. And from a guy who, my job is to connect equipment. And so connecting equipment that is not new is very, very, very difficult. And in order to get, like you mentioned here, real-time insights into production, which is basically looking at a piece of equipment connected to a network broadcast to something, somehow, some way. The most difficult thing I think there is in manufacturing today on the digital side. You talk about there's 90% of the companies in this country all use legacy equipment that has been around for 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And then how do we make that smart is the biggest question. So how do we make a dumb piece of equipment smart? And that is the largest challenge. So from that, we also have to have dumb equipment smart, and then also translate that to process data that you're going to use for analytics outside of just visibility, now becomes the largest challenge we feel in the environment today.
Yeah, another aspect to the real-time component of this question, I guess, is really back to what we were talking about earlier with hybrid versus either just cloud or just edge solutions. Hybrid kind of lets you take a very future-proof approach. For instance, if you decide later that maybe originally real time only means maybe every hour or every minute to you, but if real time certainly means every second, well, you're going to be pretty screwed if you chose a cloud-only solution. Whereas if you have a hybrid solution, well, then you have compute that's distributed across your lines, and you might actually feasibly be able to respond in real time. That's kind of another component to it, like how you distribute your compute devices and how much data you're able to process and what kind of throughput you're going to be able to handle with the system that you put in place. That's all going to factor into your ability to accomplish real time for a given definition of what real time might be.
A great point of what is the definition of real time in your environment. So, you know, if you're making a part every 15 or 20 seconds or even sometimes less than that, then yeah, your real time needs to be, you know, in the milliseconds. If your real time is a, you know, a 4 or 5 hour cycle time, then it's a difference of opinion of what real time is. So now I may be using some kind of a machine learning real time inside the panel to be making adjustments to the actual, you know, maybe it's a CNC milling piece of equipment where I'm making changes to my cutter path, or I'm making changes to the way my program is interpreted based off of what my outcome needs to be. Whereas, like you just talked about, I need to make split decisions on the fly, sub 1 second, in order to change my process that I'm doing right now. So your point, what is real time, is excellent. But again, it all comes back to being able to network the equipment back to whatever infrastructure you're trying to solve for. So do we need it to make decisions? Do we need it for visibility? Do we need it for whatever? Whatever the case might be, we still need to get that equipment connected in order to do whatever real time means.
Yeah, for sure. That component is absolutely crucial, especially for that legacy equipment where the PLCs might be extremely limited, or perhaps not even necessarily reprogrammable by the purchaser.
So I'm curious on this point about legacy equipment. Matt, in your opinion, is it necessary to essentially, if you've got say like a CNC from 1975, do you need to instrument that so that it's equivalent to a CNC that was built in, you know, 2020, or how far forward do you need to bring it, if you understand what I'm saying?
I do, and it all depends on what you want out of it. Now, you're obviously capped at what you're going to be able to get, right? So, you know, we've done equipment as far back that was built in the 40s and 50s that has relay logic, where you're going to have to bolt on a PLC that's going to communicate with it, but you're not going to get what you're going to get with the latest and greatest, newest CNC equipment. So now your question to yourself needs to be, what do I want to get out of that equipment, and what do I need it to do, and how do I expect something that is really, really old to give me state-of-the-art conclusions? And then now it becomes, what is my manufacturing model in order to get the output of the quality expectations of the factory? And that's basically, you need to come to some conclusion that says, okay, in order for me to get that result, I'm going to need these inputs. And if I don't get those inputs from that piece of equipment, what do I need to add on to that equipment in order to get what I need? Does that make sense, JC?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And there's also the additional problem of, is my process of taking this machine into the future repeatable for my other manufacturing lines as well? For instance, do I have the same model of this machine everywhere, or do I have a sequence of different versions of the same piece of equipment that all require something slightly different? That's another consideration that you need to make. And at that point, you got to wonder, is it worth going through the effort of upgrading this thing, or do I need to buy a new piece of equipment, or what's the trade-off there?
Yeah, so now you can use that information in another data set to say, is my return on investment by, I'm going to use the word manufacturing scrap for lack of a better word. So I'm using an outdated piece of equipment that I cannot, you know, determine what my process characteristics that I need to control dependently are. So I'm going to have X amount of scrap, which involves now overtime, premium freight, all the other things that go along with it. Can I use that as a rate of return in order to upgrade my equipment to something current? I guess now becomes the next question.
I'm curious as well, is there any sort of top-down approach to this? I mean, I think if this makes sense, we're talking a lot about bottom-up in terms of adding sensors to old machines. Is JC, is there anything we can infer through machine learning about instrument equipment that's not instrument?
Well, that's an interesting question. I guess in this example, you have data collected from the corresponding piece of equipment for that, in your example, somewhere else. So one plant might have, for instance, a much newer version of that piece of equipment, and another plant might have kind of this outdated, let's say, non-informative version of this piece of equipment. Or is it kind of what you're asking? Or
yeah, I think so.
Would we be able to tell, I guess, like what influence that piece of equipment has overall in the process?
Yeah. If we could look at, you know, parts before and after they go through, say, a particular process and infer the effect there, I'm out of my element here technically. So
No worries. I think you could. So the way that I would approach that problem is basically try and, basically what you want to do, you want to kind of predict what the outcomes are going to be on the line that that has that outdated piece of equipment, using models that you've constructed on the line that does have that upgraded piece of equipment. And I'd also factor out the data from that model. So I'd basically take that piece of equipment, chuck out any data that you've collected from it for this particular model, train only on the data you've collected that's present in both. And then obviously you'd have to bridge the gap between the two if there's any kind of significant difference in their data's distribution, which could get quite complicated. But ultimately, with the objective of seeing, does my model that has learned to explain one line, does it do a good job of explaining the other? And if it does a really poor job, and hopefully you have a third line to compare it with as well, does it do a poor job of explaining that one line with the poor set of equipment with as compared to a line that has the upgraded equipment? If that's the case, then you have some weak evidence that that one piece of equipment is actually contributing to the losses that you're seeing. And that would kind of be, I guess, the data science approach. I suppose you could actually zoom into that machine and kind of make recordings about its output more directly, maybe even on paper for a couple weeks and see what the outcomes are from that perspective, kind of as a zoomed in study. That's a very interesting question. Matt, would you know an approach that would be used for solving that problem, or how would you tackle that?
So if there is new equipment running the same product as old equipment, I would probably think that would be the rare. The normal would be I've got an old piece of CNC that is running a part that's been around forever. You know, if anybody works on the Ford Econoline, that Econoline's been around since, you know, whatever, the 70s or 80s. And, you know, 9 out of 10 suppliers are still running it on the same equipment that it ran way back when, because, you know, the volumes don't justify potentially getting all new equipment. So I would go the opposite way. I would go quality output, determine what the population looks like in terms of failure, and then try to figure out what is influencing that output, and then try to add some kind of new technology to recognize and predict when it would fail. That would be my suggestion.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Basically, zooming out to the problem at hand, like not focusing too much on this machine, but ultimately, yeah, if your goal is improving the KPIs, then let's improve the KPIs.
Yeah, I agree completely.
Okay, I think that brings us to our final planned question, at least, which is sort of the big one. Where should data science fit in your innovation roadmap?
So I guess the subtext here is the innovation roadmap for Industry 4.0. That's an interesting question, because it kind of matters what part of the data science equation you're kind of executing at a given time. So it's kind of a chicken and egg problem here, in terms of you can't really do too much data science without data, but at the same time, you can't really decide what data to collect necessarily without doing at least a little bit of upfront work in terms of what kind of data science do I actually want to do. Do I want to train models? Do I want to do simple statistics? Do I want to be able to make global choices or local choices? You're going to have to at least answer some of these things before you do the actual data aggregation and kind of structuring component of the roadmap. Does that make sense? It's kind of you have to do a little bit of both. You have to put it early on in the roadmap as you're making choices about what to do, and you also have to put it later on, obviously, when you're actually doing the grunt work of data analysis.
So I deal with this question pretty much every day. And my suggestion and my, you know, consulting, let's call it that, is use the innovation in multiple methods. So as you're setting your roadmap of what you want your factory of the future to look like, pick something that's going to develop an ROI. I'm going to use the word instantly or as quickly as humanly possible that makes a change, whether it's cultural as well as, you know, bottom line, that is going to make an effect that people want to get on board and have this industry 4.0 culture be part of their everyday life. And while you're doing that, you have your other team or your process engineering team starting to put the building blocks in place and develop what you would deem as your, you know, worst case or best case for your proof of concept. And so as you're innovating towards a goal, you know, you're going towards, I want my factory of the future to look like this. And 9 times out of 10, people are talking more about visually and what it's going to look like on the factory floor, not only to the operator, but to the C-suite and everywhere in between. And then as we're building our factory of the future, we get our roadblocks or our building blocks, I should say, in terms of what our process data is going to look like, and then determine from there how you can institute it now back into the innovation roadmap so that I know that I'm going to now be solving for quality problems that are coming down the road or machine failure problems coming down the road after I've already got my train already moving. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. More like an iterative approach as opposed to like a strict waterfall. Like you need to start small with some quick wins that are very clear for everybody, and kind of continue to create those across the entire organization, I guess. Is that
yeah, what you're getting at? For sure. And as you build your roadmap governance and we all have a common goal, and, you know, and I think that every factory of the future should have multiple facets of data, whether it's process data that's going to be used for machine learning, or whether it's, you know, your visual data that you're going to use for making decisions on your frontline leadership, whatever those things are all determined in your roadmap. You know, the more precise you can make that roadmap, and then start to filter in what these other, you know, their shiny light, let's call it, that's what a lot of people call them, is as we determine that we can use our process data to solve a bigger problem, then everybody now gets on board. This is, okay, yeah, I'm a frontline leader, so I now know when that machine's broken down, and they'll, oh yeah, by the way, now we're gonna develop some AI that comes along with it where I'm gonna predict when that widget's gonna fail. And then so his job becomes easier, or her job becomes easier. And as those things all start to build on top of each other, your culture will change. And your innovation roadmap has to be based on your culture change to go along with the data change that goes with it.
Yeah, so I guess basically to answer the question directly, where should it be in the roadmap? Almost everywhere.
Yeah. Yep, it's got to be at the forefront of your thought, and then it's got to be... It needs to be at some point in time the basis of everything that's going on if you want to be a predictive model. So if you want to be able to predict what's going to happen, then your data science chunk, whether it's, you know, predicting a spindle failure on a CNC equipment or predicting your widget is going to be out of position by whatever, 2 millimeters, whether it's part quality or whether it's machine interpretation, it's got to be part of your innovation all the way through, in terms of small chunks, in order to get to a larger goal.
I'm just noticing an observation in the chat here, which seems sort of pertinent to what we're talking about now. Arjun commented that the push everything to data lake sort of strategy in manufacturing comes from not involving data scientists in data collection or strategy discussions. So I guess that's a sort of another way of phrasing this question, right? How important are data scientists to the innovation roadmap?
I think especially when it comes to advising about what data and what structure and what organization, they're going to be able to help you a lot. In fact, you're going to need more than just a data scientist. You're going to need probably ETL engineers or ML engineers and similar people who are effectively software engineers by training, but also have their toe dipped into the data science world and kind of understand what their needs and requirements are, because it's not just a science problem. It's an engineering problem too, right? It's ultimately got to be a multidisciplinary team that really tackles this kind of problem. And leaving out a data scientist in the process is obviously going to cause issues down the line if ultimately when it comes time to do the data science, you don't have the right stuff.
I concur completely.
Okay. Well, we've had a few questions come in over the course of the discussion. Please, to our audience, if you have any other questions that you'd like to ask Matt or JC, feel free to pop them into the chat now. But let's see how many of these we can sort of cover in the time we have remaining. One question that I think maybe you touched on a little bit, Matt, I'd be curious to know your thoughts on this. How has the coronavirus affected data science and manufacturing?
Well, in terms of data science, I know that it's kind of ironic. Another company that I work with is taking predictive analytics coming from sewage and using that to extrapolate back to the amount of infections in a certain population. So if you think about it science-wise, there are scientists that are working with predictive analytics, taking known results from sewage samples and predicting what the infection rate is in a certain population, which is unbelievable. But on top of that, like I mentioned earlier, it goes back to the visualization piece. So as people are not necessarily being able to work from a manufacturing location unless you are intrinsic to the operation, you know, but a lot of the people, you know, the majority of us, you know, are a byproduct of the manufacturing environment. Those people are now working from an exterior location where they need visibility to what's going on the floor. So they all kind of blend together. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's how I've seen it over the last obviously 4 or 5 months.
Yeah, I would say generally I've seen an increase in demand for data science and its applications on the manufacturing line as well. Just kind of in the interests of being more efficient, staying leaner, and optimizing for costs. I think there's definitely been an increase in interest since COVID.
Okay. Next question. Have either of you seen any regional differences in terms of data strategy in manufacturing?
Well, that's an interesting question for many different applications of data science. So respecting privacy and protecting people's privacy is obviously something that's challenging when you're collecting an enormous amount of data about them. Luckily, in manufacturing, there's not a lot of personally identifying information. So I think most of the time you're somewhat immune to the differences in legislation around protection of privacy. So in Canada, we have PIPEDA, you have the European standards as well. What is its acronym again? GRPD or something like that. Forget. But ultimately, there's lots of different legislation around protecting people's privacy. And obviously, that does cause a difference to occur. But I think the difference is somewhat low for manufacturing, in my experience, at least. What do you think, Matt?
I don't see any difference in any region. The manufacturing landscape is basically, I'm going to use the word the same, but you know, we're doing work from coast to coast. So it doesn't, I don't see any changes or any specific requests from one region versus another.
Another question that's come up. One challenge to the iterative approach for quick wins is that it looks a lot like the incremental improvements that manufacturing does all the time. How do we move from proving value through quick wins to getting teams to make the big leap investments, such as hiring the right people and installing systems?
So I'm reading that question on the chat as well, and it's a fantastic question. So the answer to that, in my opinion, is to pick something that is detrimental to the landscape of the manufacturing facility. So you're right. A lot of tiny little quick wins look like, you know, all the small pickups in your continuous improvement roadmap, without a doubt. But there's always going to be something that is there that is intrinsically a challenge that is constant. Pick that constant and solve for it, and everybody will change their tune immediately. So I can speak from experience in you know, running plants and being, you know, the head of manufacturing engineering for, you know, multi-billion dollar tier one, where we took one of our largest investments in terms of a capital equipment, and we put a dynamic, you know, system in place on top of it due to the fact that we had some severe pressure from the customer, and used that as our, you know, as this exact question, big leap investment, which in turn allowed us to use that and roll it out to the rest of the globe. So I would pick something that is intrinsic to the operation that is detrimental to the operation at the same time.
Okay. JC, did you want to add anything to that or?
No, I think that was perfect. I think that captured it perfectly.
Okay, great. So I think it's sort of maybe looking at things from the other side. What's the most common mistake that you see people making when it comes to building up their data strategy?
Definitely traceability. Too many times I've come upon a data set where I have a lot of data, but I actually can't put any of it together because it's unclear where the data came from. And what I mean here is really like, I'll have some data that's connected to some unit or some product, but I won't have the serial number. I won't actually be able to connect that back to the rest of the data that was collected from that particular unit. And it happens time and time again. And it's a really challenging problem to get right. Identity is really weird because sometimes you're going to have to backfill serial numbers because that product, as it's being manufactured, when does it actually become an axle? When does it actually become a transmission? It's almost kind of a philosophical problem, like how many grains of sand make a pile, right? How many boards do you replace on a ship before it becomes a different ship, right? The ship of Theseus problem. Because if you go into rework, do you get and it gets a new serial number? Is it actually a new product or not, right? You have to make those kinds of choices when doing your analysis. And if you have incomplete information, it just makes the problem so much more complicated and so much more difficult. So yeah, that's definitely the challenge or the mistake that I've seen made most frequently.
And to go back to kind of our original conversation is unstructured. So part of what JC is talking about is structured data based off of sequence or based off of a specific part identifier, serial number, let's call it. But the other thing is so much data that doesn't really mean anything that gets construed into the product or into the model that really has no bearing on anything, I think is another large chunk of wasting the data scientist time analyzing data that really has no bearing or no explicit impact on anything.
Okay, great. We are almost out of time. I think we have time for one or two more questions. What's the biggest obstacle to getting started, in your opinion?
That's a tricky one. I guess it depends on what stage you're in. I guess getting started here is basically having no data infrastructure whatsoever, I suppose. I think the challenge there, in my experience, has been really kind of twofold. Both how do we upgrade the equipment that's there to be able to do what we needed to do, to our discussion earlier, but also how do we actually convince people within the organization that this effort is worthwhile. What about you, Matt?
Yeah. So the convincing part is for sure. And that goes back to my previous comment that says pick something that's decorative, you know, pick something that is a thorn in everybody's side and solve for that. So obviously, especially in the COVID era, everybody has taken CapEx spending and chopped it to zero to try to preserve as much cash as possible. So the influence of spending money to save money is a very difficult concept for most people to understand. So your conclusion has to be finite in order to make sure that everybody understands what our goal is. So if you set a vision statement for what that particular thing you want to solve is and make sure that you can justify the return, then people will sit up and listen. But again, like what JC was alluding to earlier, if you do not have a correct data set or the ability to collect data, then that is always step one. Always step one is, what do I need to do in order to solve this problem? And how do I get the data and what data do I need to collect? And then from there, develop your strategy on what your end result is and what it's going to take to get there, and build a mini roadmap that works outside of your larger roadmap.
Okay. Last question, and this is maybe a bit of a tricky one. I'm not sure, but I'm sure one you've both heard before. How long does it take usually to achieve ROI with the first project?
Yeah, that's definitely a tricky question, and I think it's going to depend on a lot of factors as well. It's going to be kind of an individual question you have to answer about your organization. Because it really depends on where you are, how much data you're able to collect now, if any, what kind of problem you're trying to solve in particular. Hopefully it's one of those quick wins so that maybe you can get a POC out the door in a couple months. But if you're really rolling something out transformatively, that might take a long time before it has a big splash. I guess that's kind of a general answer, but it's kind of a tricky one to answer. Specifically, I guess the fastest that I've seen on ROI is probably on the order of months, just a couple months. But it has taken much longer in some cases, sometimes closer to 6 months to a year before you see anything out of it.
Very difficult question. It also depends on how much you're spending. So, and what the problem is. So, you know, JC and I have worked on machine learning projects that took years, where we've also worked on, you know, a simple CNC offset solution where the payback was probably in days. It totally depends on what the outcome you're expecting is. So if you're expecting $1 million result, then it's going to take time. If you're expecting a couple $1,000 result, then you should expect it to be almost instantaneous. So I guess the ends justify the means.
All right. Well, we're almost out of time. So I want to thank Matt and JC for their participation. Thanks to our audience for your attendance and your interest. If you came in late, don't worry. We'll be making a recording of this webinar available on the Acerta website very soon. So thanks again, everyone, and take care.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Thanks, JC.
Yeah. Thanks, Matt. Thanks, Ian. I think this is very nice.